Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 5th of June. We talk about Bobby Kennedy this hour with the author of an absolutely compelling book about him, The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy in 82 Days That Inspired America. Thurston Clark is our guest this hour. Thurston has written 11 books of fiction and nonfiction, including three New York Times notable books, The Last Caravan, Equator, and California Fault. His Pearl Harbor Ghosts was the basis of a CBS documentary, and his best-selling Lost Hero was made into an award-winning NBC miniseries. He has written articles for Vanity Fair, Glamour, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many other publications. I couldn't put the book down, actually. I just kept reading and reading it yesterday. He starts the book with the prologue, which really brings tears to your eyes and is the funeral train of Robert Kennedy, and what people, journalists, were seeing as they looked out the windows of this train, just to give you a sense of his writing and the enormity of the day of this funeral train. Anyone who owned an American flag had flown it or brought it. They saw flags flying at half-staff in front of factories and schools, dipped by American Legion honor guards, and waved by Cub Scouts. Anyone owning a uniform had worn it. They saw policemen in gold braid and white gloves, fire companies standing at attention next to their trucks, and veterans in Eisenhower jackets and overseas caps snapping salutes. They saw the kind of white working-class backlash voters who had supported former Alabama Governor George Wallace's 1964 candidacy for the Democratic nomination and would vote again for Wallace or Republican Richard Nixon in November, although until 4 days before many had planned to vote for Robert Kennedy. Today, these whites had not only turned out to mourn a politician who was an acknowledged champion of black Americans and who had condemned an American war as deeply wrong, they had decided that the most fitting way to do this was to wear a uniform and wave a flag. We're so happy to have Thurston with us, who provides a really complex portrait of Bobby Kennedy, who was a complex political figure and lived a life that wasn't very easy, right? Well, welcome phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We will. I'd love to have a chance to play this speech, play a good portion of what was a very short speech that Kennedy gave in Indianapolis. And Thurston sets up this scene so marvelously. I had no idea all that was going on in the neighborhood in which Bobby Kennedy was appearing right after Martin Luther King was shot and gave this speech with no notes from the heart, quoting Aeschylus, and what happened to the crowd as a result of that speech. I just think it's a remarkable moment in history. And we welcome your phone calls, your emails, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Thurston. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to talk about Bobby Kennedy today.
Yeah, it is nice to talk about him. And I just love your book. It's just filled with the complexity of the man and the mood of the country at that time. It was such a hard time, a real moral crisis for Americans in 1968. It was hard, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were in a position. We had an unpopular war and an increasingly unpopular president who was waging it. That might sound familiar.
Yeah.
We also had the really serious riots that had hit the American inner cities in 65, 66, and 67, and would happen again, of course, after Martin Luther King was assassinated. So the country was divided, and I think people, Americans wanted to feel noble again. People talk about Bobby Kennedy and hope. I mean, the hope that he was holding out really was that we could again, as he once put it, that Americans could find their way back to those ideals which were the basis of our national strength and compassion and generosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one reason that a lot of the white working class voters responded to him, because they sensed too that they wanted to feel better about their country, mm-hmm. even if they supported the war. So.
You present the man in his complexity as well, because there was, you know, maybe a good Bobby, maybe a bad Bobby, but he changed after his brother's assassination, and this image of him being the tough attorney general, you know, taken on in some ways Martin Luther King, and being responsible for some of the Vietnam War, which he later apologized for. But there was a transformation in him.
Yes, by the time, you're absolutely right, by the time he was running for president, these 82 days, he was really a man, a politician and a man who I think was at his best. One of the reporters covering him for Time magazine, Hayes Gorey, wrote a pretty critical piece of Bobby after he delivered a speech in Los Angeles during the campaign in which he accused the Johnson administration of really calling forth the worst impulses in the American spirit. And afterwards, Gorey said, you know, on reflection, I realized that all of the reporters liked Kennedy so much, and we thought he was doing such an incredibly good job, and people were literally falling in love with him, that whenever we kept looking for things that we could jump on him for, just to prove to our editors and prove to ourselves that we hadn't really come over to the, you know, to his side. And I had to be careful about that when I wrote the book, too. I had to be careful not to look for things just so I could say, hey, look, I'm giving you a balanced portrait. And I think it is a balanced portrait, but at the same time, you have to remember these were 82 days when this man was on fire. And he was at his best.
Right. I like this description of him, which seems to me fairly important in how we hold people in high regard, that he meant what he said.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, this is another reason. This is something that people sensed, voters across the political spectrum. He didn't pander to his audiences. This is also one of the reasons, of course, that he had such bitter enemies, because they knew that if he said he was going to do something, he was probably going to do it when he was president. And if you didn't like what he was offering, then you were against him, and then you were afraid of Bobby Kennedy. And there were a number of people like that. But the honesty sometimes got him in trouble with audiences. Again and again, he would tell an audience really the last thing they wanted to hear. It was kind of reverse demagoguery. he would tell college students that he was against the deferments that saved them from fighting in the college deferments that saved them from fighting in Vietnam. And a whole auditorium that had been applauding him, a minute later he'd hear boos and catcalls, and then he'd spend 10 minutes kind of back and forth reasoning with them, trying to educate them and explain why it was wrong, morally wrong, for people who could afford a college education not to go to Vietnam, not to fight, not to sacrifice, and to leave it to the minorities and to the poor boys.
Mm-hmm. And was it this feeling that the Vietnam War was immoral? And he spoke at great length about what was happening to the Vietnamese people as a result of our being there. Was that the motivating force, in addition to his concern about poverty in the country, that got him in the race?
Absolutely. He, I like to say he painted himself into a moral corner. There's this appearance that I think was very important that he did on Meet the Press in November of 67, when he condemned the war as morally wrong and went on and on about the bombing and the that all Americans were individually responsible for what the government was doing in their name in Vietnam. And one of the panelists said, well, Senator Kennedy, if you feel that way, then why aren't you running for president? And, you know, he had no good answer for that. There was no answer to it. Then he got himself in a position. Of course, Ted Kennedy, his brother, and most of the advisors, as he told Arthur Schlesinger, most of the people I respect and trust were all against him running.
Mm-hmm.
Ethel Kennedy wanted him to run because she knew he'd be miserable. She knew him best of anybody and knew he'd be miserable if he didn't run. So as we moved through that winter of 1968, it became clear that it was not only morally impossible, but also politically impossible for him not to run, because in good conscience, he couldn't support Johnson. And if he couldn't support the nominee of his own party, he was going to be in political trouble with the Mayor Daley and the other bosses who controlled the nominating process. On the other hand, if he went ahead and supported Johnson, he'd be doing something that was morally abhorrent to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is why there's this incredible reaction after his first full day of campaigning, when he delivers speeches in Kansas State and University of Kansas, very conservative student bodies, relatively conservative. And he was very worried that what he was going to say was going to be poorly received. I mean, imagine a politician, the first speech of your campaign, and you say to people moments before you give it, you know, what I'm about to say is not going to be very well received here.
Right.
Well, he turned out to be wrong. And in the plane going back, he roamed down the aisle saying to the reporters, I feel free, I feel free, I feel like a man again.
Mm-hmm. And that feeling just grew during those 82 days. He was just
high. Liberated.
Right.
Liberated. The first 2 weeks... was his advisors called it the Free at Last tour, because he was suddenly, you know, free to say what he meant, what he felt about Vietnam and about poverty and everything else. And it was a very exhilarating couple of weeks.
Right. What about the issue of poverty? Here's a guy who grows up with a swimming pool in his backyard and this very wealthy family, and yet he exposed the issue of poverty in such a dramatic fashion and really took it on so that you believed it was coming from his heart, that he thought this was another moral issue. America should be embarrassed about this. This shouldn't happen.
Yes. I think the really unique thing about Bobby Kennedy was that he had a very active moral imagination. And what this meant was that when he went, for example, to Mississippi, and when he went into the sharecropper's shacks in 1967, and he saw these children who were literally starving, because then you needed money to buy food stamps, and they had no money whatsoever. When he saw these children, he imagined his own children being there. He imagined his own children starving. He didn't just feel sorry for those children. He put his children in their place. The same thing when he went to inner-city neighborhoods. He imagined himself living in one of these neighborhoods. When he spoke to farmers, I mean, who would have less in common than Nebraska farmers but Bobby Kennedy?
Right.
But they could sense, I think, the farmers and the Mexican-American farm workers and the white working class ethnics, that this was a man who knew what it was like to be them, that Kennedy was constantly putting himself in other people's position. I'll give you just one final example. He even put himself in position of the people who were against him. He was shaking hands in a factory in Indiana one day, and there was a white man who made a terrible racist comment to Kennedy. He said, "I won't shake your hand." He used four-letter words. It was just terrible. And Robert Kennedy noticed that this man was working next to an African-American, a black American. And afterwards, instead of being upset, he said to his aides, "My God, imagine what that man must be like inside. Imagine to feel that way about blacks, and then have to work next to them every day. He must be just torn up inside." So again, he was putting himself in this man's position.
Mm-hmm. What was it about Bobby Kennedy that attracted this phenomenal support from black Americans? It was phenomenal.
Yeah. When he was in the Senate, first of all, although he started out as Attorney General, not particularly sympathetic to the civil rights movement. In fact, he and his brother dragging their feet in the first 4 months of his administration, his brother's administration, because they were worried about the new African nations at the UN and worried about the freedom riders giving the United States a black eye. And so they wanted things to go slowly. Kennedy came around, as his brother did, and by the end of the JFK's administration, by the end of the 3 years that he was president, Kennedy was much more sympathetic to voting rights, integration, elimination of all the Jim Crow restrictions, and had really come about, and was prodding his brother. And the black Americans understood that. Also, when he was in the Senate, he became a champion of for inner city projects. He started his own project in Bedford-Stuyvesant, a partnership between private industry and local people. So he had great credibility. And then once Martin Luther King was assassinated, it was Bobby Kennedy that black Americans looked to.
Right.
Congressman John Lewis and the other, who was at the funeral, told me, I can remember, you know, just thinking, well, thank God, at least, you know, Martin's gone, but now we've at least we've got still got Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
And at the night before the funeral, Hosea Williams, one of King's lieutenants, stood up and said, you know, you can be a prophet. In other words, you're our prophet now. Hmm. He said, you can be a prophet, but remember something, and that is that prophets get shot.
Hmm. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return. I do want to play that speech, which I love so much, that he delivered in Indianapolis right after Martin Luther King was shot. And Thurston has done great background on what was happening in that community. A lot of information that I never knew. I knew about the speech, but I didn't know about what was happening among the people, the Kennedy supporters, the African-Americans who were living in the neighborhood, some of whom were ready to get Kennedy and to start burning the community. It's quite a story. So we'll listen to that speech and have him set it up for us in just one moment. We'll also be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Thurston Clark is our guest. He is author of The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thurston Clark, our guest. His book is The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Before we hear that speech in Indianapolis, let's take a phone call or two. Adam from Marshfield. Hi, Adam.
Oh, good morning. Just before I begin my comment, I'd like to let you know where I come from. I was a teenager when these events happened, and I was an enormous fan of President John F. Kennedy. I had all his political campaign materials. I had about a 10-inch wide steel button that said, if I were 21, I'd vote for Jack Kennedy. I believe that his assassination was the greatest political tragedy of my lifetime. But Bobby Kennedy did at least two things that I just can't abide. And number one, he was one of the co-counsels on the Joe McCarthy's communist witch hunt hearings against the U.S. Army and the Senate,
mm-hmm.
Along with Bob Cohen, I think was his name. And then the other thing is that with that senator from down south, Estes Kefauver, he ran that hearing in the Senate in the middle 50s that really pilloried and savaged the union movement in America and organized labor in particular. And this was at a time when we did have the one crooked union, the Teamsters, and one probably with communist influence, the East Coast Longshoremen. And George Meany, who was the head of the Federation, kicked both of those unions out because of their corrupt practices. But Bobby Kennedy didn't take any note of that. He just savaged the labor movement in those committee hearings in the Senate. I know that because my father was briefly a local union president at the time, and he took the train to go all the way to Washington, D.C. and try to testify at that awful hearing and give a positive note on organized labor in America. And Bobby Kennedy wouldn't even let him testify.
Mm-hmm. So, and you describe that Bobby Kennedy in the book. What yeah. transformed him? And did some people
The book is about his 82-day campaign,
right.
But I do say in the very beginning of the book, I said that this was a man who was no saint, and he
yeah.
had a complicated history, and I brought up the McCarthy hearings and the other hearings. But by the time we get to 1968, this is a different Robert Kennedy than the one who had supported, who had worked on Joe McCarthy's staff 15 years ago. And it was the changes that had occurred in him after his brother's assassination and after some of the trips that he took to the South. He had become a much gentler person.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt that he would have, as president, if he'd become president, that you would have seen the same Bobby Kennedy that worked for Joe McCarthy and was the a Senate counsel on the Rackets Committee.
Mm-hmm. We're going to play a portion of the speech that he gave in Indianapolis, a very tough part of the city after the assassination of Martin Luther King. Set up the scene for us. You do it so completely. I didn't know all the details of what the crowd was like.
Yeah. There was a rally scheduled at 17th and Broadway in the middle of a very tough neighborhood in Indianapolis, and already even before King was assassinated, on April 4th, Mayor Lugar had called Mike Riley, who was the head of Kennedy's campaign organization in Indiana, and said, "I want you to cancel the rally. The neighborhood's too dangerous." And Riley said, "We're not going to cancel it. He's going to go ahead. Are you telling me you can't protect a presidential candidate?" Lugar said, "If you go ahead, I'm going to have the fire department put hoses down to keep cars from going." Mm. And he said, Riley said, "Well, then we'll walk." Mm. So there was already this worry on the part of the authorities in Indianapolis about this neighborhood and about Bobby Kennedy going there. Now, he was flying into Indianapolis. He had spoken in Muncie at Ball State. And as he got on the plane, he heard that King had been shot. When he arrived in Indianapolis, he found out that he'd died. The police chief was there, and he told him not to go. Some of his aides had called from Washington and said that they recommended that he not go and that he issue a statement and go to his hotel. Kennedy refused. He said, "I'm going. I'm going to go, and I'm going to speak, and that's it." And he scribbled a few notes on the drive there. He arrived, and most of the histories will say that the crowd of 3,000 people, they didn't know what had happened to King. This was before we had cell phones and before we had CNN and everything. But actually what I found out is that about half of the crowd didn't know, and that was the crowd that was around this flatbed truck where he was going to speak. But circling them were people who did know and were very angry. And there were some militant groups there. The people were armed. There were guns. There were Molotov cocktails. As one person said afterwards to a researcher from Purdue, "We were ready to burn that city down." Hmm. So Kennedy faced a crowd that part of it was already hostile and ready to riot. Mm-hmm. He had to do two things. He had to demonstrate, I think he did demonstrate, two kinds of courage. First was the physical courage to go before that audience. And then there was the moral courage to give an extemporaneous speech that was going to offer them comfort and hope. You know, he was taking a risk, because if he had said something that somehow upset the African-American community, he could have lost his most loyal constituency. On the other hand, if people had rioted after his speech, even though there were riots in other cities, his opponents would say, "Robert Kennedy can't, you know, control his African-American constituency, and he stirred up the riots." So he stands up there and gives this 7-minute speech that he composes in his head as he's giving it. And the other thing you notice when you see the film of it is that he's choking up all the time. His eyes are watering. There's a catch in his voice. Mm-hmm. And, well, we'll hear the speech, and then we can talk about the extraordinary thing he does in it.
Okay. And here is the speech, most of it.
Do they know about Martin Luther King?
We have left it up to you, and the listeners can be handled.
Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own day despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
Most of Robert Kennedy's speech,
yeah,
not all of it, but
still
it's
very
moving.
Powerful,
it is so powerful to listen to that, isn't it? It is so powerful.
Well, the two things that really, from the part we heard, that stand out, of course, him mentioning his brother's death,
mm-hmm,
for the first time in public.
Hmm.
He had never before mentioned it in public. This was a very big thing for him. Obviously, King's assassination was reminding him of his brother's assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly he was reliving it through the King assassination. And the other thing is the Aeschylus quote.
Yes.
And, I mean, here he is quoting Aeschylus to an inner-city African-American, largely African-American audience. And he did this again and again throughout the campaign. He would quote Camus and Emerson,
mm-hmm,
Aeschylus, Sophocles. He would quote them to inner-city audiences, to college audiences, housewives, farmers. It didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't speak down,
mm-hmm,
to the people he was talking to. He never did that. And parenthetically, also, he never dressed down. He was always in this coat and tie suit, French cuffs and everything. But, you know, after that speech was over, he went back to his hotel, and he was with John Lewis, and John Lewis saw him just suddenly collapse,
mm,
and fell weeping face down on, mm, a bed. And about 2 hours later, he did the same thing in front of a campaign worker, Joan Braden, and he knocked on her door. She opened the door, and he looked at her, and he said, "Joni, it could have been me." And then he fell on her bed and was crying.
Mm-hmm.
What's not clear, as I point out in the book, is exactly, and perhaps not clear to him, who he was crying for.
Mm-hmm.
Was he crying for King? Was he crying for the country? Was he crying for his brother? Was he crying for himself, for Coretta Scott King, who he knew was going to suffer just as Jackie Kennedy had? Or was he crying for all of those things?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a bit of all of them.
I
but there's no doubt that he was profoundly moved by King's assassination.
Mm-hmm. I was alive during that time. I remember those days, and we were all crying, too, for all of it, for,
yeah,
what you just mentioned, for all that had happened, and for you know, the sucking out of hope. We thought, that's it. That's it.
Yeah.
It was sad. He also had meetings, which I had never heard this reported before, of some people from the Black Power movement in that community who really,
yeah,
wanted to burn the city. Tell me about those meetings.
Well, he had these scheduled beforehand, and Jim Tolan, who was his advance man, was a wonderful memory for the campaign, and really was one of his right hand, one of Kennedy's really right hand men, had set up these meetings, and he had the people, the man named Snooky Hendricks, who was a representative of H. Rapp Brown, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He had some very radical local ministers, and they all, Kennedy said, "I'm going to go ahead with the meeting." So they were all upstairs waiting for Kennedy, and he finally came in, and they just began to light into him. They said, "Listen, you're just here for our vote. You know, you don't care about us and everything." And Kennedy just let them have it right back. He said, "You know, I don't need this." He said, "I could be sitting by my swimming pool." He said, "I'm not doing this, you know, just to get elected. I care." And he went on and on. And at the end, they were all asking him how they could work for him, how they were going to get out the vote. And he starts to leave. And you see, they suddenly feel, you know, kind of, this guy is leaving us, who we now, you know, now we trust. And they say to him, "Well, what's going to happen? You're going to fly away tomorrow. And then what are we going to do?" And then he says, "Well, it's true. I am going to fly away, but I'm going to give you one of my right-hand men. And when you talk to him, you talk to me."
You ask the question repeatedly in the prologue as you so movingly create the funeral train and people who are on that train. What did he have that he could do this to people?
Right. Just back up for a second. That was said by Sylvia Wright, who was the Life magazine correspondent. The train was going slowly. People were looking out the windows at the 2 million people lining the tracks, and she noticed a whole bridal party standing in a meadow in outside of Wilmington, Delaware. They had to have been there for a couple of hours because the train was late. As the train went by, the bridesmaids all tossed their bouquets at the car carrying Kennedy's coffin. And that caused Wright to think, to say to herself, my God, what did he have that he could do this to people? And I think the answer to that is in the book. If I had to give a short answer, I would repeat what John Nolan, one of his aides, said to me. He said, "You know, it's not that complicated what Bobby Kennedy did, and it could happen again. All you need is someone who knows himself and has some courage." And the courage is key, because, again, we're talking not just about physical courage, which he had in abundance, but we're also talking about moral courage.
Right. And the physical courage, I mean, all the Kennedys seem to have this, of going into waters where there were dangerous creatures and doing the rafting trips and all of that. They had this phenomenal physical courage.
And of course, for him, just the act of going out every day with these crowds without any Secret Service protection, because Secret Service didn't protect candidates in the primaries then, but to go to drive in these open cars in long motorcades after what had happened to his brother in Dallas, and to plunge into these crowds unprotected to shake hands was an extraordinary act of courage. He was scared. I mean, he liked to say, "Oh, what happens, and I can't worry about that." But enough things happened, and I picked up enough things to see that yes, he was brave, but he was also understood the risks he was taking.
The crowds were frenzied. I remember seeing him in Omaha back in 1968 in an open field, and people were just frenzied. They were pulling at his cufflinks and at his shirt, and it was quite a sight.
And, you know, his aides, you would say to him, people said they had this dinner one night, and they said, "Bobby, why don't you campaign, you know, do more television campaigning, you know, go into a television studio, campaign from television. You know, these crowds, they're turning off some voters because your campaign is beginning to look like a traveling riot." And Kennedy realized this. He once said, "I've got to stop looking like Frank Sinatra running for president." But at the end of the day, what he said was, he said, "Listen, I just can't campaign that way." And it's true. He wasn't very good on television. He was much better in person. And then he said a couple of things to explain why he was campaigning this way. He said, "You know, there's so many people that hate me that I've got to let the people who love me get at me." Also, he took his cues from a crowd. He would look at expressions. He'd look how people were reacting to what he was saying. He would read the signs. And he was constantly going off on these spontaneous riffs about poverty or about race, or the, and it was often a response to the faces and the reactions you know, that he saw in the crowd.
Mm-hmm. And you also say he had this peripheral vision, so he could see somebody in distress way out of the corner of his right eye, or he could take in.
That's extraordinary. Yes, he had this peripheral. He could, you know, people tested him. One of his reporters once didn't think he was really paying attention, and he liked to say he studied every face of every person he shook their hand that he shook hands with. Well, maybe a slight exaggeration, but one of the reporters got into one of those rope lines at the airport, and Kennedy was going down shaking hands. Kennedy shook his hand, looked at him, and said, "Oh my God, it's you." And he was looking at every face. And afterwards, he would say to people, "Did you see their faces? Did you see their faces?"
Mm.
And he would, you know, one of the comments he made several times was, "Look, have you ever looked at the faces of black children in America? You know, they're so beautiful. When they're young, their faces are filled with such hope. And then when you look at them when they're teenagers and they realize what they're up against," he said, "the hope has vanished from those faces." So he needed the crowds. He needed the energy that he got from crowds too, because he didn't like this kind of campaigning. And the crowds revived him. He'd be down, he'd be exhausted, he'd turn a corner, he'd see a crowd, and suddenly he'd say to Fred Dutton, his campaign manager, you know, "These are my people. These are my people." And there'd be this transformation that would occur.
Let's go to Leah from Green Bay. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for this nice program. I wanted to recommend a companion book, which I'm sure your speaker knows about. A photographer by the name of Paul Fusco did an amazing pictorial view of the train going back from California to the East Coast of all the people who were standing there, you know, like the bridesmaids you mentioned.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Rich, poor, white, black. I mean, just looking at that book, you realize the power of photography and also, of course, of his personality.
That book is being reissued in September.
Oh, is it?
It is being reissued. Right now, there's a wonderful book by Bill Eppridge, who I interviewed for my book, who was a photographer on the Kennedy campaign. And he's got a book that came out. I had the Vanity Fair did an excerpt from my book, and they used Bill's photographs, and they're just wonderful. They're color, they're wonderful photographs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a funny thing happened when I interviewed Bill. He'd also photographed the Beatles at Carnegie Hall in 1964, and he took the photos that he'd taken of the crowds of the young people looking at the Beatles and Kennedy, Robert Kennedy's crowds, and he said, "Look at these photographs." He said, "You can't tell them apart," and it was true. Same expression of rapture, and the same thing on the faces of Carnegie Hall and the Bobby Kennedy.
Interesting. Yeah. Thanks, Leah, for the call. And if you want to join us, our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Email is talk@wpr.org. Bonnie from Madison is next. Hi, Bonnie.
Well, hi, Kathleen. Well, I did admire Bobby Kennedy in a number of respects, but I was one of the students who worked for Gene McCarthy back then, and McCarthy was the first candidate that came out that very strongly and effectively spoke against the war, and it seemed like Kennedy was holding back.
Well, you're right. He was holding back, and he decided to get in before McCarthy did so well in New Hampshire, but he was told not to by Senator McGovern and a lot of his advisors because it would have split the anti-war vote. They were afraid that he would get a big write-in vote. You know, I was originally a big McCarthy supporter, and then he came to New Haven, Connecticut, where I was, and I heard him speak, and it was just a tremendous letdown. He seemed very diffident, and this was just a day or two after New Hampshire, and that's when I kind of switched my allegiance. But there was a lot of bitterness about Bobby getting in the way he did. He made a comment about reassessing his position, which was an unfortunate thing to say the day after McCarthy's success in New Hampshire. But he really had made up his mind before that, and he wasn't just jumping in because of McCarthy's success.
Did you switch your allegiance, Bonnie, or not?
Well, I would have voted for him, I think, if he had gotten the nomination.
Right.
Though, as your guest said, we did feel a little bit bitter about it. I even remember the adjective opportunistic applied to Bobby Kennedy.
That's right. opportunistic and ruthless. And it certainly, even his supporters, Jack Newfield, and wrote a very sympathetic book about the Kennedy and the campaign, think it was that the way he handled it and the words he chose and the timing, he should have waited another day or two.
He didn't think much of McCarthy, did he?
No, he didn't think anything of McCarthy, right. I'm afraid. And I think it was reciprocated, too. He didn't think McCarthy was qualified to be president.
Right.
He thought he was lazy. And McCarthy didn't like him either. Mm. They both remembered that McCarthy had delivered the nominating speech for Adlai Stevenson in 1960, who was the last best hope of people who wanted to stop JFK from getting the nomination. And Bobby Kennedy remembered that. He was someone who did keep grudges against people.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Thurston Clark is our guest, author of a wonderful book just released, The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Our number is 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to your phone calls at 800-486-8655. Thurston Clark, author of The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America, just released by Henry Holt, is our guest this hour. Bob is next from Richland Center. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that I had heard Robert Kennedy speak at the Marquette University graduation in 1963.
Mm.
And I'll never forget the speech because I was one of 15,000 or 20,000 in the audience, and you felt like he was addressing you. And I don't know if we've really seen the likes of his speaking abilities and leadership, you know, in that respect since his day.
Well, I think it's interesting you say that. People who met him in person, even in large groups or small groups, they all said the same thing. You know, I went back and retraced his route through Indiana and Nebraska, South Dakota, and met a lot of the people who'd never been asked about Robert Kennedy before. Some of them had worked in his campaign and met him for a few minutes. Some had been in the audience. And they said, and they had similar comments to what you just made, particularly the people who got to ask him a question or people who sat with him in a car for a minute or two. They said, you felt as if there was no one else he wanted to talk to but you, and that he was kind of concentrating on what you said and listening to what you said. And he made people feel important. He made the people, even if it was just a 30 seconds or a minute, they never forgot it. And a lot of these people, their lives were changed by their contact with Robert Kennedy. One person who rode with him on a train in Nebraska who was organizing things, met him for 15 minutes, went into law school and is now the head of legal aid in Nebraska. Jerry Abramson, who's been the mayor of Louisville, Kentucky for 16 years, inspired by the Kennedy campaign, named his son Robert.
Isn't that something? And what about the young student he met on a reservation, wasn't it? And he invited him to come and spend the summer with the Kennedys?
Yeah, that was an orphaned young Indian boy. He was about 11 years old, huh. Christopher Pretty Boy. And his parents had died in a car accident the week before.
Hmm.
And Kennedy met him in the cabin where he was staying with his aunt. And he said, spend the day with me. And when you see newsreel photos of that visit, to Pine Ridge, you'll see Kennedy holding the hand of Christopher Pretty Boy, and at the end of the day, he invited him to come and spend time in the summer at the Kennedy compound in Hyannis and play with his children. Unfortunately, of course, Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
And Christopher Pretty Boy died within a year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh. Bob, thanks for the call. Eileen from Richmond. Hi.
Hi. Barack Obama is running sort of on the philosophy of empathy deficit, you know, throughout the country. So do you see Obama as sort of another Bobby Kennedy?
Well, there's such, you know, there are similarities with the war and, you know, that we are in a similar situation. But the politics is so different now, partly because of the internet and the 24-hour news hour. You know, it's a different kind of political environment, so it's hard to make a lot of comparisons. I think that they both sense, as I said, this connection between how you campaign and how you govern in the end if you become president. One of the big differences I see is really Obama's style. Some of the things he says are reminiscent of Bobby Kennedy, but his style is very much a JFK style. Mm-hmm. He's more aloof than Bobby Kennedy, less likely to let himself go in front of a crowd. I mean, people said again and again about Bobby Kennedy, who was very shy and kind of stammered, that he looked so vulnerable. I heard women say, I just wanted to go up and hug him.
Right.
Around him.
Right.
And I don't think people say that about Obama. He's more of a JFK character. He's cooler. He's a little bit more aloof. And, you know, that works as well. But the styles are quite different. The content is similar times, and some of the content mm-hmm. is
fixed. Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. We go to Jim from Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I was telling your interviewer that my mother, Dorothy H. McLaughlin, God bless her soul, was Bobby's vice treasurer for Massachusetts in '68. And what I wanted, I don't, your speaker today is so insightful. I don't think that Bobby became kinder over his life. Bobby had, you know, Kennedy was the kind of person who, you know, you were either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. He was a very intense person. I think, reflects the '60s, and there was a transformation of his beliefs, not his personality, but, you know, there was a man who went from the Army McCarthy hearings in the '50s to being the person he was in '68, and I think that Bobby Kennedy had an intensity and compassion and conviction of believing that there were stark contrasts between what is right and what is wrong, and regardless of what a soundbite would be.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you were either with the angels or you were with Mephistopheles. And he would quote the Greeks on that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I agree. I think that you see this again and again during the campaign, and he was tough on himself too. You know, one of his paid political advertisements in Indiana showed him sitting down with a group of VFW American vets in with their hats and everything, saying to them, you know, the administration of which I was a part bears a heavy load of responsibility for the mess that we're in Vietnam. And he said, and not just the administration, but me personally, I'm personally responsible for this.
Right. What do you think? I just think it's marvelous that he would just quote these, you know, Aeschylus and Emerson, and have quotes in his office from poets. It seems to me as though his life was informed in some way by Greek philosophy in a way that you don't see too many politicians embrace.
Well, he turned to the Greeks for comfort after his brother's assassination and read Edith Hamilton's book, The Greek Way, and then started reading the tragedies in 1964. And he'd memorized these were, again, these were not phrases inserted into his speeches by a speechwriter.
No.
These were words that he had memorized, that he had pondered, that had given him comfort, that were important to him. So this wasn't a speechwriter's trick. This was Bobby Kennedy telling people what he thought was important and the kind of authors that were important to him. Same with Camus and Emerson.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Ron from La Crosse, and we're running short on time, everybody. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'd like to point out there's little known historical fact as to why this Sirhan, this Jordanian immigrant, assassinated Kennedy. Prior to a hawkish speech that Kennedy delivered on behalf of Israel, remember this was less than a year after the Six-Day War in the Mideast, he said something to effect in his speech that instead of sending all these arms to Vietnam, we ought to withdraw and use some of the arms that were earmarked for Vietnam and send them to Israel so they boost their defenses against their hostile neighbors. Sirhan did not hate Kennedy prior to the speech, but after he heard this somewhat hawkish support from Kennedy on behalf of Israel, his attitude towards Kennedy changed 180 degrees to homicidal anger, and the rest is history.
Thurston.
Well, yeah. You know, my book is not about the assassination, but I've read enough. And I think that's a disputed point. There are people who believe that the whole Israel business was an ex post facto excuse that Sirhan kind of grasped to give himself, to give his act a certain political and even moral legitimacy. And there's plenty of evidence on both sides, some evidence that that he was upset by this, but there's also evidence that he hadn't been really terribly politically active in the Palestinian cause, and evidence that this was something that he stressed after he'd been arrested.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing how many people, all of his age, that you talk about early in the book, the number of people who love this man. He had a lot of love.
Yes, I saw it again and again when I did the interviews, when I went out, when I went to Washington and talked to the people who knew him, and when I went out to and talked to people who'd listened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Very often the interviews would end with the person I was talking to choking up,
right,
being unable to continue.
Right, yeah, that happens when you read the book, too. Thank you so much. I loved your book.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thurston Clark, and the book is The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for your calls. Veronica Rickard is with you on Fridays with her program, and I'll be with you again on Monday. Thank you for listening.